You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Grand Pop by Mark Rotzo. When Ruscha got to L.A., he enrolled at the Schuinar Art Institute, now Cal Arts, aiming toward commercial art. Seeing Jasper John's target with four faces in a magazine, he has said, was an atomic bomb in my training. At Schuinar, abstract expressionism held sway, but now Ruscha realized he could work in a way that was premeditated, that is, proceeding from a plan and painting actual things found in everyday life, protopop. He tacked decisively toward fine art, supplementing the rent with a gig hand-painting names on novelty denture containers labeled Ma and Pa Chopper Hopper. He added words to his own paintings, starting with place names. Soon enough, words took over and became entire pictures, including perhaps the best-known, Oof, a trilogy of sans-serif block letters in cadmium yellow against cobalt and Bellini blue. It is now part of the Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. Ruscha had found his sweet spot, ingeniously redirecting words from the workaday realm of commercial art into the upper stratosphere of art history. Ruscha's words came across as hilarious, Delphic, glib, blankly transcribed from everyday speech, like a 19th-century salon artist fixated on a famous model, he'd taken as his most identifiable, longest-running subject, the very component parts of the information age. Words evolved into phrases, and occasionally palindromes, such as 2002's Tulsa Slut, along with a repertoire of pet typefaces, most notably his sharp-edged, instantly identifiable Boy Scout utility modern. Ruscha has been asked ad infinitum about the starring role of words in his work, and he has remarked epigrammatically that they have temperatures. At other times, he has described them as objects, and the early word paintings do play like flat still lifes. For anyone who has spent time in L.A., word paintings like another Hollywood dream bubble popped, and Honey, I Twisted Through More Damn Traffic Today are practically social realism. Ruscha's words also have a giddying cognitive effect. Your brain pings back and forth between reading them as language and looking at them as forms. His notebooks and sketch pads brim over with words and phrases pulled out of the ether. A lot of things come from the radio, he told me. Sometimes he picks up on snippets of conversation, the way Nashville songwriters overhear throwaway lines that become top 10 hits. He showed me a recent work with the phrase mop up on aisle 2. I heard this in a department store, he said. Does Ruscha ever have a great idea for a word or phrase that doesn't pan out? Yeah, he said, I do that when I smoke dope. If I get too high, well, then I start writing things down. It's really kind of exciting. You say, oh man, wow, look, this is great, right? The next day you say, this is foolish. It's so amateurish. Ruscha has done countless works involving words, and yet the bar is high. Many don't make the cut. Rolex chainsaw, he said, is a phrase he's been pondering. He rolled it around. It's on the back burner, he concluded. The oft-cited lightheartedness of Ruscha's work is, in fact, a heavyweight strength. Those visual wisecracks, rendered with immense skill, can bring out walloping double takes. The 1976 pastel on paper, nice, hot vegetables, for instance, catches me off guard every time I see it. Is it profound? Does it matter? You just have to go with it, usually to a place somewhere way out beyond interpretation. The fashion designer Stella McCartney, who called upon Ruscha to collaborate on her winter 2016 campaign, summed up the appeal. The humor that Ed has, I find it sort of challenges you, and at the same time it sort of frees you from thought. Ruscha's approach produced considerable bafflement as he was making his name. Was he celebrated? Not at all, Bloom said. There were no precedents. It all started to change, and fast. In 1962, when the legendary curator Walter Hopps, a Ferris founder, included Ruscha in his new Paintings of Common Objects show at the Pasadena Art Museum, along with the likes of Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein. It was pop art's big bang. The family who built the Space Needle in Seattle bought one of the Ruscha's in the show for $50, the artist's first sale. The young actors Dennis Hopper and Brooke Hayward came to Ruscha's 1964 Ferris show and were blown away by the 10-foot-wide Standard Station, Amarillo, Texas. They bought it for $780, leaving Ruscha gobsmacked. It is a 20th-century icon, and perhaps Ruscha's best-known early work, its vaulting diagonals inspired by the old filmmaking trick of shooting an onrushing locomotive from a low angle, a masterful example of bringing machine-age velocity to a still image. Ruscha and Hopper remained lifelong friends. The artist's reputation spread quickly. Warhol marveled at the photographs in his 1963 book, 26 Gasoline Stations. Ooh, I love that there are no people in them. The Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni came to visit the studio. John Lennon bought a stark black-and-white word picture, Jelly. There followed Ruscha's paintings of buildings on fire, including the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, his gunpowder drawings, and his romance with liquids, in which he turned words into viscous trompe-l'oeil, such as Annie, poured from maple syrup. At the end of the 60s, there came a wave of ball bearings, aspirins, cocktail olives, small round things tumbling in picture space. Ruscha gave up on paint for a spell and started messing around with organic matter. Blueberry extract, Fernet Branca, tobacco, even human blood. He created a room made of Nestle chocolate for the 1970 Venice Biennale. I'm just variations on a theme, Ruscha told me. If so, the variations have been endless, the themes ineffable. In the studio's airy library, Ruscha dug out a copy of the 1967 book he did with Mason Williams and photographer Patrick Blackwell, another Oklahoman, called Royal Road Test. It documented in forensic fashion a caper in which Ruscha's Royal typewriter was tossed out of Williams' Buick LeSabre at 90 miles an hour along a desert highway. Ruscha showed me the book, and then, with an appreciative chuckle, brought out a companion piece. A recent exacting homage by a team of Japanese artists, who instead destroyed an early-generation iMac. It's just one product of a sub-industry of Ruscha tributes. It's also evidence of Ruscha's indelible impact on art and artist. Yet Ruscha, in typical fashion, demurred, I don't see that many artists that have been influenced by me. Tom Sachs, a Gen X assemblage provocateur, laughed when I mentioned this remark to him. He's a titan with a tremendous influence, he said, mentioning his own Ruscha knockoff project, 150 Chevy vans I did not buy. I can't think of anyone alive who has had a bigger influence on my own work. Sachs made sure to add, I'm not alone. Christopher Riopel, the curator of the upcoming London show, said that Ruscha's prestige is not confined to this side of the Atlantic. He certainly seems to be the one that young artists here are looking at a lot. Thanks to Ruscha, he said, Los Angeles now holds more attraction for them than New York. The next thing over the horizon, he said, summing up a growing feeling in the art world, you're going to see it in L.A. One afternoon at the studio, Ruscha brought me over to a recent work called Our Flag, a nearly 6x12-foot painting of the Stars and Stripes flying into violent tatters across a deep navy background. Ruscha plans to bring it to Vienna in the fall, making it the centerpiece of his secession show. He pointed to one lumpen, free-flowing white tatter in the painting. See, he said, a charging warthog. Upon close inspection, it did look something like a charging warthog. Ruscha tends to see meaningful shapes, figures, and faces in random, seemingly ho-hum places. A visual hyperacuity that is the artist equivalent of a musician's perfect pitch. I like any attention given to something that doesn't require attention, he has said. It has the ring of manifesto. In a way, Our Flag feels like a distant relative of Ruscha's Course of Empire series, going on view at the National Gallery in London on June 11th. Ruscha told me that Thomas Cole's own Course of Empire, a cycle of landscapes from the 1830s, showing the same craggy scene evolving from pastoral Eden to post-urban ruin, inspired him to begin addressing the passage of time, decay, deterioration, in his own work. It's from Ago. Ruscha's Course of Empire pairs his five enormous washed-out blue-collar paintings from 1992 with five later paintings in color that update those industrial scenes. The old trade school is now boarded up. The Tech Chem warehouse has been renamed Fat Boy, which could be a burger joint or urban haberdashery. Who knows? In his work, Ruscha has always kept politics at bay. There is peril in reading too much into his pictures, which are booby-trapped, to defeat that very impulse. Yet he seems to have taken a turn with Course of Empire, and Our Flag, along with the recent Psycho Spaghetti Western paintings, with their crushed Bud Light boxes and piles of detritus, and an emerging series of double-negative phrases painted on old drumheads that have a Daffy Orwellian slant. They suggest a more pointed critique of where we are, shredded values, environmental degradation, mangled discourse, than Ruscha has ever ventured. A couple of weeks after showing me Our Flag, the artist touched down in New York City for a few days to give a talk at the Metropolitan Museum, which was then hosting the Cole Show before it moved to London. He took a room at the Carlisle, met up with friends, went to a game at Yankee Stadium, my first visit, he said, and they won. Backstage at the Met, he and Dana moved amid a chattering whirl of admirers and friends. Ruscha, wearing a yellow polo shirt, was the low-key center of gravity. Met curator Elizabeth Mankin Kornhauser, who also helped organize the Cole Show, mentioned how good he can be on stage. Droll, charismatic, a total natural, cool. And so the packed house, a conspicuously youthful crowd for the Met, laughed when Ruscha talked about throwing that typewriter out of the Buick. They nodded in appreciation when he said, in his gnomic way, a painting is just a picture with paint. They cheered when he made an unexpectedly strong statement about the threats facing America's national parks. With one passing remark, he provoked a collective sigh of relief that blew through the room. "I know one thing," Ruchet said, prodded once again to reveal the mysteries of his modus operandi, 60 years and running. "I can't stop doing this." American Hustle. A magical heiress in Gucci sandals and Celine glasses walked into my life and showed me a glamorous frictionless world of hotel living, Le Coucou dinners, and Moroccan vacations. Then she made my $62,000 disappear. By Rachel Deloach Williams. Opening photo by Rachel Deloach Williams. Anna Sorokin in the Medina Marrakesh, May 16, 2017. According to my closest friends and various suspect internet sources, turning 29 on January 29, 2017 marked my golden birthday. At the time, I wasn't sure what that meant, but I had a gut feeling about my 30th year. It was going to be special. It was going to be good. It was a total disaster. It began with Anna. In her signature black athleisure wear and oversized Celine sunglasses, she sat beside me in the SUV, pecking at her phone. Seemingly everything she owned was packed into Rimowa suitcases and stacked in the trunk just behind our heads. We were running late. Anna was always late. Our SUV hummed along the cobblestones of Manhattan's Crosby Street as we drove from 11 Howard, the hotel Anna had called home for 3 months, to the Mercer, the hotel Anna planned to move into when we got back from our trip. The bellhops at the Mercer helped us to offload her bags, all but one, and checked them away to await Anna's return. Our errand complete, we climbed back into the car and set off for JFK, 2 hours before our flight. We were Marrakesh-bound. I first met Anna the previous year in early 2016 at Happy Ending, a restaurant lounge on Broome Street with a bistro on the ground floor and a popular nightclub past the bouncer one flight down. I was with friends in the lounge downstairs. It was a group that I saw almost exclusively on nights out, fashion friends whom I'd met since moving to the city in 2010. We walked in as the space was kicking into gear, not empty, but not crowded. Young men and women made laps through machine-pumped fog. I can't remember which arrived first, the expectant bucket of ice and stack of glasses, or Anna Delvey, but I knew that she had appeared, and with her came bottle service. She was a stranger to me, and yet not unknown. I'd seen her on Instagram, smiling at events, drinking at parties, oftentimes alongside my own friends and acquaintances. I'd seen that at Anna Delvey, since changed to at Anna DLVV, had some 40,000 followers. The new arrival, in a clingy black dress and flat Gucci sandals, slid into the banquette. She had a cherubic face with large blue eyes and pouty lips. Her features and proportions were classical, almost anachronistic, with a roundness that would suit Ingres or John Curran. She greeted me, and her ambiguously accented voice was unexpectedly high-pitched. Pleasantries led to discussion of how Anna first came into our friend group. She said she had interned for Purple Magazine in Paris. I'd seen her in photos with the magazine's editor-in-chief, and evidently traveled in similar social circles. "I work at Vanity Fair," I told her. The usual dialogue ensued. In the photo department, I elaborated. "Yes, I love it. I've been there for 6 years." She was attentive and engaged. She ordered another bottle of vodka. She picked up the tab. Not long after that first encounter, I was invited to join Anna and a mutual friend for dinner at Harry's, a steakhouse downtown, not far from my office. Anna told us huffily that she'd spent the day in meetings with lawyers. "What for?" I asked. She lit up. She was hard at work on her art foundation, a dynamic visual arts center dedicated to contemporary art, she explained, referring vaguely to a family trust. She planned to lease the historic church missions house, a building on Park Avenue South and 22nd Street, to set up a night lounge, a bar, art galleries, a studio space, restaurants, and a members-only club. In my line of work, I had often encountered ambitious, well-off individuals. So, though her undertaking sounded grand in scale and promising in theory, my sincere enthusiasm hardly outweighed a measured skepticism. For the rest of 2016, I saw Anna every few weekends. As a visiting German citizen, she'd explained, she didn't have a full-time residence. She was living in the standard, High Line, not far from my small apartment in Manhattan's West Village. Anna intrigued me, and she seemed eager to be friends. I was flattered. I saw her on adventure-filled nights out, for drinks and sometimes dinner, usually with a group, but occasionally just the two of us. On Saturday, May 13, 2017, we landed in Marrakesh. Our hotel sent a VIP service to greet us at the airport. We were escorted through customs and taken to two awaiting Land Rovers, and after a 10-minute drive, we pulled up to a palatial compound and entered through its gates. Miss Delvey opted for a tour of the grounds for her and her guest. We proceeded directly, not having any need for keys or a traditional check-in procedure, since our villa was staffed with a full-time butler, and according to Anna, our host, all billing had been settled in advance. The vacation was Anna's idea. She again needed to leave the States in order to reset her visa, she said. Instead of returning home to Germany, she suggested we take a trip somewhere warm. It had been a long time since my last vacation. I happily agreed that we should explore options, thinking we'd find off-season fares to the Dominican Republic or Turks and Caicos. Anna suggested Marrakesh. She'd always wanted to go. She picked La Momonia, a 5-star luxury resort ranked among the best in the world, and knowing that her selection was cost-prohibitive for my budget, she nonchalantly offered to cover my flights, the hotel, and expenses. She reserved a $7,000-a-night private riad, a traditional Moroccan villa with an interior courtyard, which had 3 bedrooms and a pool, and forwarded me the confirmation email. Due to a seemingly minor snafu, I'd put the plane tickets on my American Express card, with Anna promising to reimburse me promptly. Since I did this all the time for work, I didn't give it a second thought. Anna also invited a personal trainer, along with a friend of mine, a photographer, whom, at a dinner the week before our trip, Anna had asked to come as a documentarian, someone to capture it all, on video. She was thinking of making a documentary about the creation of her art foundation, and she wanted to experience what it felt like to have someone around with a camera. We spent our first day and a half exploring all that La Momonia had to offer. We roamed the gardens, relaxed in the hammam, swam in our villa's private pool, took a tour of the wine cellar, and ate dinner to the intoxicating rhythms of live Moroccan music, before capping our night with cocktails in the jazzy Churchill Bar. In the morning, Anna arranged for a private tennis lesson. We met her afterward for breakfast at the poolside buffet. Between adventures, our butler appeared, as if by magic, with fresh watermelon and chilled bottles of rosé. Anna was no stranger to decadence. Next photos, the author and Sorokin in the Jardin Majorelle, and the entrance to La Momonia Hotel. When she'd returned to New York City in early 2017, after a time away to get her visa, supposedly with her family in Cologne, she checked into 11 Howard, a trendy hotel in Soho. Her routine dinner spot became Le Coco, winner of the James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant that same year, which was on the ground level of her hotel. Buckwheat fried Montauk eel to start, and then the burrito, her dishes of choice. She befriended the staff and even the chef, Daniel Rose, who upon her request obligingly made off-the-menu bouillabaisse just for her. Dinners were accompanied by abundant white wine. Her days were spent at meetings and on phone calls, often in her hotel. She regularly went to Christian Zamora for $400 full eyelash extensions or $140 touch-ups here and there. She went to Marie Robinson Salon for color, Sally Hirschberger for cuts. She toured multi-million-dollar apartments with over-eager real estate people and chartered a private plane for a weekend trip to Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholders meeting in Omaha. All things in excess, she shopped, ate, and drank, usually wearing a Supreme hoodie, workout pants, and sneakers. She embodied a lazy sort of luxury. Anna checked into 11 Howard on a Sunday in February, and that same day invited me to lunch. She'd texted me occasionally while she was away, excited to get back and eager to catch up. I wondered if she kept in touch with other friends that way. She had a directness that could be off-putting and a sort of comical overconfidence that I found equal parts abhorrent and amusing. She isolated herself, and I felt privileged to be one of the few people whom she liked and trusted. Though I had no trust fund or savings of my own, her world wasn't so foreign to me, a tweaked and amplified version of things I'd seen, and I was pleased that she could tell that she accepted me as someone who got it. I met her at Mamo, a restaurant on West Broadway. Anna had settled into the L-shaped booth closest to the door. Above her hung an oversized movie poster of Lino Ventura and Jean-Paul Belmondo, both holding guns, floating above a dark cityscape. "Asfalto che scoccia," it read, in caps locked Italian. She had come directly from the Apple store, where she'd purchased a new laptop and two new iPhones, one for her international number and one for a new local number, she said. She ordered a Bellini, and I followed her lead. When we finally left, it was almost 5 o'clock. We walked toward Anna's hotel, and she invited me in for a drink. We passed through 11 Howard's modern lobby, heading straight for the steel spiral staircase to the left, which swooped twice around a thick column rising to the floor above. On the second level, we entered a large living room called the library. The room's design had distinctly Scandinavian overtones. My eyes scanned the setup and paused on a photograph that hung in a frame across from the concierge desk. A black-and-white image of an empty theater, part of a series by Japanese photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto. Light emanated from a seemingly blank rectangular movie screen, casting its glow out from the center of the composition onto the empty stage, seats, and theater. Sugimoto used a large-format camera and set his exposure to be the full length of a film, hoping to capture a movie's thousands of still frames within a single image. The result was otherworldly. Looking at his work always reminded me of Shakespeare, a play within a play. It captured kinetic energy, portentous and alive with emotion and light. The viewing experience was meta and inverted. I was the audience, looking into an empty theater beneath a blank screen. Anything was possible, or maybe it had already happened. Maybe it was already there. Maybe it was all already there. Next photos, a private pool in one of La Mamounia's riads. Sorokin in Marrakesh, May 15th, 2017. After that day in February, Anna and I became fast friends. The world was charmed when she was around. The normal rules didn't seem to apply. Her lifestyle was full of convenience, and its easy materialism was seductive. She began seeing a personal trainer and invited me to join. The sessions were her treat, as she generously insisted that working out was more fun with a friend. We went as frequently as 3 or 4 times a week, often ending our sessions with a visit to the infrared sauna. Anna did most of the talking. She held court, having befriended the hotel staff and Le Coucou servers, with me as her trusted advisor and loyal confidant. She would tell me about her meetings with restaurateurs, hedge fund managers, lawyers, and bankers, and her frustration over delays with the lease signing. She was set on the church missions house. She mused about chefs she liked to bring in, artists she esteemed, exhibitions that were opening. She was savvy. I felt a mixture of pity and admiration for Anna. She didn't have many friends, and she wasn't close with her family. She said that her relationship with her parents felt rooted more in business than in love. But she was strong. Anna had a sort of tactlessness that caused a rift between her and the friends through whom we'd met, but I felt that I understood her and would be there for her when others were not. Anna was a character. Her default setting was haughty, but she didn't take herself too seriously. She was quirky and erratic. She acted with the entitlement and impulsivity of a once-spoiled, seldom-disciplined child, offset by a tendency to befriend workers rather than management. In the male-dominated business world, she was unapologetically ambitious, and I liked this about her. She was audacious where I was reserved, and irreverent where I was polite. We balanced each other. I normalized her eccentric behavior as she challenged my sense of propriety and dared me to have fun. As an added bonus, she paid for everything. It was late on Monday afternoon, after almost 2 full days in Lamamunia's walled palace. It was time to venture out. Anna wanted 2 things, piles of spices worthy of an Instagram photo, and a place to buy some Moroccan kaftans. La Momania's concierge arranged everything. Within minutes we had a tour guide and set off with a car and driver. Our van came to a stop, and we stepped out, one by one, fresh from our sheltered resort life, into the dusty warmth of the Medina's mysterious gaze. "Can you make this dress, but with black linen?" Anna asked of a woman in La Maison du Captain Marocain. Before the woman could reply, Anna continued, "I'll take 1 in black and 1 in white linen, and, Rachel, I'd love to get one for you." I scanned the store's racks as Anna tried on a bright red jumpsuit and a range of gauzy sheer dresses. I tried on a few things, but wary of the iffy fabric content and high prices, I soon joined the videographer and trainer in the shop's seating area for glasses of mint tea. Anna went to pay. Her debit card was declined. "Did you tell your banks that you were traveling?" I asked. "No," was her reply. So I wasn't surprised that such a purchase would be flagged. Anna asked to borrow money, promising to reimburse me the following week. I agreed, careful to keep track of the receipt. We wandered the Medina until dusk. Back in the van, we went directly to La Sultana for dinner. I paid for that, too, adding it to my tab. On Tuesday, we were walking through La Mamounia's lobby, leaving for a visit to the Jardin Manjerel, when a hotel employee waved Anna to a stop. "Miss Delvey, may we speak with you?" he said, as he tactfully pulled her aside. "Is everything okay?" I asked, when she rejoined the group. "Yes," Anna reassured me. "I just need to call my bank." The next morning, I, too, was stopped as I passed through the lobby. "Miss Williams, have you seen Miss Delvey?" I sent Anna to the concierge. She was agitated by the inconvenience. You could always tell when Anna was agitated. She made almost comical huffy noises, ugh, why, and typed furiously on her phone. She left the villa and came back shortly after, ostensibly relieved that the situation was being resolved. We set off on a day trip to the Atlas Mountains and returned to Marrakesh after dinner that same evening, re-entering La Mamounia through the main lobby. Two men stepped forward as Anna approached. They pulled her aside, and she sat down to make a call while the videographer and I lingered awkwardly to the side. As we waited, an employee mentioned that someone had been fired because of the trouble with our villa's payment. The men followed us back to our villa as Anna spoke clipped phrases into her phone. They stood ominously at the edge of our living room. I offered them chairs, but they declined. Anna sat in front of them, intensely focused. I excused myself, feeling the embarrassment of the situation, and thinking it best to give Anna some privacy, since there was nothing I could do to help. The men insisted that a functioning card was needed for a block on the reservation's balance only, not to be charged for the final bill, which could be settled later. First Anna, and then the men, pressured me to put down my credit card for that block, while Anna sorted out the situation with her bank. I was stuck. I had exactly $410.03 in my checking account. I had no alternative transportation from the hotel. I wanted to go home. And most importantly, I was told that my card would not be charged. At any rate, I knew Anna was good for the money. I'd seen her spend so much of it. You learn a lot about someone when you travel together. I left Marrakesh early the next day, before Anna and the videographer. As I arrived back in New York, I received a text from Anna promising that she'd forward a wire confirmation as soon as possible. "I'll wire you $70,000. That way everything's covered," she said. I suddenly understood that she intended to leave the hotel charges on my account, to add that amount to the total she owed me from expenses outside the hotel. The balance was more money than I net annually. Anna stayed in touch daily, but in the following week I did not receive the wire as I'd been promised. I attributed her delay to disorganization and a failure to grasp the urgency of my situation. I was frustrated, but not surprised, by her ineptitude, and I assumed the international wire transfer was just taking longer than expected. Her text became increasingly Kafkaesque. Assurances of incoming reimbursements through varying methods of payment that never materialized. She spun a web of promises that grew self-referential and complex. Seeking reimbursement from Anna became a full-time job. Stress consumed my sleep and fueled my days. My co-workers saw me unravel. I came to the office looking pale and undone. At last, a month after I left Marrakesh, Anna claimed to have picked up a cashier's check. This news should have incited a wave of relief, but instead, I remained skeptical. The next morning, I showed up unannounced at the Beekman Hotel, where she was now staying. The Mercer was sold out, she said, and rang Anna from the concierge desk. She answered, sounding groggy. "Hey, I'm here," I said. "What's your room number?" Her room was a mess. Papers were everywhere. Her suitcases lay open and overflowing. Her black linen dress from Morocco hung in dry cleaner's plastic from an open closet door. "Where's the check?" I asked, trying to make the transaction simple. She shuffled through piles of papers, looked under clothing, and dumped out various bags, before claiming to have left the check in the Tesla she'd driven back from upstate. Of course, it couldn't be easy. Of course, there was a problem. She called the Tesla dealership, and then her lawyer's office. He must have it, she said. I refused to leave. Anna said the check would be dropped off, so I waited. I went with her to Le Coucou, where she met with a different lawyer and a private wealth manager. I followed her back to the lobby in the Beekman, where she ordered oysters and a bottle of white wine. I sat in silence, sending work emails from my phone, largely ignoring Anna, but keeping a watchful eye and asking periodically for an update. To prove a point, I stayed until 11 p.m. I left angrily, telling her I'd be back at 8 a.m. so we could go together to the bank. She agreed. I hope you had fun, at least, she chirped, with an impish grin. No, this was not fun. This is not okay, I stammered incredulously. The next morning, I arrived at the hotel on time. Anna was not there. I was livid. Her overt evasion confirmed what I had feared most. Anna was not to be trusted. Finally, why had it taken me so long? I began to investigate. I reached out to the friends through whom I'd met Anna and was referred to a guy who'd once lent her money. He was German, like she'd said she was, and had known Anna since she lived in Paris. He told me a story that was alarming and reassuring in equal measure. He said that after weeks of pestering, he had gotten his money back by threatening to involve the authorities. Her dad is a Russian billionaire, he said. He brings oil from Russia to Germany. The details obviously came directly from Anna, but they didn't add up. Anna had told me that her parents worked in solar energy. He said Anna had told him that she received around $30,000 at the start of each month and blew through it, and that she had stood to inherit $10 million on her 26th birthday, the previous January. But because she was such a mess, her father had arranged for the inheritance to be delayed until September of the same year, just a few months away. I knew that something wasn't right. I searched for a way to reach Anna's parents, but could find none. On the week of July 4th, while I was in South Carolina with my family, who knew nothing of the situation, I received a text from the trainer. She told me that Anna was asleep on her couch. Did she not have another place to stay? 2 days later, Anna texted me, too, asking if she could stay at my apartment. I said no. A day later, Anna called me, crying. I can't be alone right now, she pleaded. I offered to meet her at her hotel. I had to check out. Can I come to you? She asked. I said no and hung up. Then my conscience got the better of me. I called her back. You can come by, but you can't stay here. She was at my door within the hour. I didn't have the energy to engage, so I said very little. My tiny studio apartment was in terrible disarray, the physical manifestation of my mental state. Piles of papers, boxes, clothing and stuff. I apologized for the mess. You don't need to apologize to me, she said. She was right. I made a conscious decision to turn the proverbial cheek. I ordered two salads and put on Bridget Jones's Diary. When she asked to sleep on my couch, I was hardly surprised. Even this far down the road, I tried to maintain an optimistic view of the situation. My friend had run into an unimaginable spell of bad luck. Any day, it would be resolved. This optimism was one of my defining characteristics, an Achilles heel. It's what allowed me to befriend Anna in the first place, a willful suspension of judgment, an earnest filtration that looked for the best in others and excused the worst. On the first day of August, I walked into a police station in Chinatown. I'd had enough. I told my story to a lieutenant. He fixated on the Morocco aspect of the situation and told me there was an insurmountable jurisdictional issue. But with your face, he said, you could start a GoFundMe page to get your money back. He suggested I try the civil court. I went outside and sobbed. When I had stopped crying, I went straight to the nearby civil court. I found a help center and spoke to a woman through an institutional plexiglass divider before a mousy man in khakis walked me over to his cubicle. I relayed my tale of woe. "Well, gee, I'm kind of jealous that you got to go to Morocco," he responded. He tried to help by offering pamphlets on pro bono lawyers, but the money involved surpassed the financial limit dealt with in civil court, he told me. I left, feeling distraught. And then came a decisive moment, an episode that unfolded like the climax of a staged drama. Just as I left civil court, Anna reappeared in the lobby of the trainer's apartment. The trainer called me immediately, and we decided to confront Anna together. The trainer also invited a friend of hers, someone she thought would be helpful, and the four of us convened at the Frying Pan, a bar on the West Side Highway. Anna was crying. She was wearing the same dress that she'd worn for weeks, alone from her night's stay in the trainer's apartment. "Have you seen what they're saying about me?" she whined. Apparently, the night before, an article had come out in the New York Post calling Anna a wannabe socialite. She'd stiffed the beatman for her stay. Her belongings had been detained. She was being charged with several misdemeanor offenses, including an embarrassing dine-and-dash incident. At an outdoor table, surrounded by young professionals boisterously enjoying after-work drinks, the four of us existed in our own little world. "We are here because we want to help you," the trainer began, "but to do that, we need to hear some truth from you, Anna." It was the same old song and dance. Anna stuck to her story, claiming that all she'd said was true. Nothing was her fault. Anna sat across from me as the women relentlessly pressed for answers, for names, for a way to reach Anna's family. I said very little as I watched. I seemed to float outside of my body while tears ran down my cheeks. Against the raised voices and direct accusations, Anna's face assumed an unsettling blankness. Her eyes were empty. I suddenly realized that I didn't know her at all. With this epiphany came a sort of release and a strange calmness. I understood the women's anger and disbelief. I'd had those feelings for months. But I had come through to the other side, and I knew that there was only one answer. The next day, I emailed the New York County District Attorney's Office, linking to an article about Anna. "I think this girl is a con artist," I wrote. An hour later, my cell phone rang. The caller ID read United States. I picked up the phone as I stepped away from my desk. "We think you're right," a voice said. An assistant district attorney confirmed that Anna Sarokin, also known as Anna Delvey, was the subject of an ongoing criminal investigation. On the last Wednesday in August, I awkwardly lowered my tote bag to the floor, resting it against the wall, before turning to face the roomful of Manhattan Grand jurors, nearly 24 faces dotting curved tiers of seating that reminded me of a college classroom. I assumed the position of a professor, though I was hardly fit to teach the group. I, the dupe, the dope, the sorry case. And then I recalled one class I might now be qualified to teach or serve as guest lecturer, the only one for which I'd received an A+ during my time at Kenyon, the Confidence Game in America, an advanced-level English course taught by Lewis Hyde, who'd written a book all about tricksters, Trickster Makes This World, Well, at least the irony was gratifying. I stood behind a small wooden table in the front of the room. The court reporter sat to my left, and an assistant district attorney stood at a podium to my right, next to a projector. The foreperson, a woman about my age, sat in the center of the back room and asked from above, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?" I did. It turned out that I wasn't the only one who'd believed in Anna. At the grand jury hearing, Anna was indicted on 6 felony charges and 1 misdemeanor charge. I realized the scope of her purported deceit as I later read the indictment. She was accused of falsifying documents from international banks, showing accounts abroad with a total balance of approximately $63.6 million. The reality of Anna's behind-the-scenes dealings, these figures flying from one account to another, remains dizzying to this day. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.